So I wonder if anyone has a favorite genre of music. You have any favorite genres of music? Yeah, Michael?
Classical.
Classical? Mm-hmm. Is that one genre or is it like 30?
It encompasses a whole array of genres.
It's got a bunch, right? Yeah.
Depending on whether you're talking about the instrumentation or the period of time.
Yeah, so it could be like instrumental or like vocal, or it could be something like opera, or it could be by period.
Music, or it could be orchestral, it could be by period.
Yeah, so like Baroque, right?
Well, yeah, Baroque, classical, romantic,
And then there's jazz, and if you know about jazz, there's like different genres of jazz. There's cool jazz, and what were you gonna say?
Or cool jazz.
Cool jazz. Oh, yeah. Denise and I both like cool jazz. Oh, then there's Kenny G, smooth jazz. Anyone still listen to Kenny G?
Oh, please.
My high school band teacher always gave Kenny G a hard time. Jake and Debbie, if you ever meet my high school band teacher, don't bring up Kenny G. Someone asked me the other day, because they learned that I play trumpet, and they're like, hey, do you like Chris Botti? And I laughed because Chris Botti was another one of the guys that my high school band teacher liked to, you know, use as a bad example of things. But okay, so there's jazz, classical,
country
pop.
Rock.
Okay.
Rock.
Now, are there songs that you can think of that could be both? Like, is it classical or is it jazz? I don't know. Sorry?
Gershwin,
yeah. Is it pop? Is it?
I don't know.
And it used to be that music on TV was like proper music, not the junk now, right? So depending on, you know, one's preferences or what one grew up with or whatever, you have different tastes, and often it'll be, oh, that's not really jazz music. That's this new weird thing called something else, right? So we have these debates. The point is, genre is a very complicated thing, right? That's what I'm getting at. It basically just means category. So any way you can categorize something is a genre. And there's no like master list up in heaven of all the correct genres of music. We've just developed them over time, and you know, they can move, and it's all up for discussion, okay? But nevertheless, there really are differences. If you walk into a jazz concert and you're like, man, these people just don't take the notes very seriously, you're missing the point, right? The guy's improvising, that's the whole point. And if you go to a classical concert, like, man, these people have no swing, you know, your criticism won't be well aimed, okay? The other thing is you would have different types of music for different things. So at a birthday party, you're probably not gonna play some, you know, grand Italian tragic opera, right? And at a, you know, at a wedding, you're probably not going to play, well, who knows? Probably people would play all sorts of things at weddings. But there's going to be different things for different occasions, different audiences, different purposes. You know, there's a really great video I saw years and years ago of a little boy who had just finished reciting the books of the Bible at his church. And then just because he was up at the mic, he took the opportunity to start belting out, "All my exes live in Texas." And it was absolutely hilarious. It was so funny. I mean, I hope nobody ever does that at our church, but that's why we don't give little boys the microphone during the worship service. But man, it was absolutely hilarious. But the reason it was so funny, I think, is because this little boy understood that's like the worst possible song for that moment, right? No one would ever play "All My Exes Live in Texas" during anything important, right? So anyways, these are all genre considerations, okay? And if you understand all these different genres of music, you've got a kind of savvy know-how about music, like you know what's the right thing to play at the right time, who will like what kind of music, when, and you'll know sort of like what's good about each kind, and you won't make dumb statements like, oh man, these jazz musicians don't know how to read the book or whatever, because you'll understand what the point is, what the purpose is, what everybody's expectations are, okay? So now think about genre when we think about writing. So same thing, like there's novels, there's plays, there's newspaper articles, there's blog posts, there's tweets. These are all very different things. And it would be a little bit lame for you to read a novel and say, you know, I don't think that person did their, you know, I fact check a bunch of that stuff and it wasn't true. You know, of course it wasn't true, it's a novel. On the other hand, sometimes our newspaper articles would be better as novels, right, than they are as reporting, right? So, in other words, we have these expectations. If you're writing a journal article for an academic journal, you write it one way. If you're writing a little piece in a magazine, you write differently. If you're writing for New Horizons, you write a certain way. It's usually very, well, you can ask me after what I think the genre is of New Horizons, but... let's just say sometimes there's this church magazine style, and I'm not always sure it's the very best writing. But there's church magazines that my family grew up with, because they were all from Northern Ireland. There was these one or two little phrases that appeared all the time. One of them was, "You will be made very welcome." No matter what the church announcement was, "You will be made very welcome. You'll be made very welcome." This would appear like 8 times in every single church magazine for years. It was, and they never thought, we've been overusing this. You'll be made very welcome. So that was a genre thing. Another one was, "A good time was had by all." Which might be the single lamest sentence that could possibly be written. A good time was had by all. I mean, there's so much could be said about that. But the point is, it's a genre, and if you're reading a kind of old school Ulster Church magazine, you expect these things and you don't get too fussed about it. So now think about all that and then think about the Bible. So people go to the Bible and they're expecting a devotional blessing, okay? And then they open the book of Judges and they think, huh, I'm not feeling very blessed. I haven't come across a single verse here that I would put on a calendar on my kitchen wall. Okay, it's just not working out very well. I wonder if you've ever had this feeling. You were like reading, I'm like, I'm just gonna keep reading until I get blessed. And there's some parts of the Bible where it doesn't seem to ever come. On the other hand, there are people who will have almost the opposite expectation, you know, the Bible's very serious and it's lots of information and we wanna treat everything, you know, we wanna learn every detail. And then what we get frustrated when there's not much detail. So for instance, there's nothing in the book of Obadiah about Obadiah. It doesn't tell us anything about who he is, when he lived. It's just like 22 verses. It's like a little fragment out of thin air. We have no information at all. Isn't that frustrating? Don't you want to know who that is, right? I would love to know, but we have no idea. Same thing with Paul in Corinthians. It's like, wouldn't it be great to have 1.5 Corinthians? The letter that Paul mentions, but we know we don't have because 1 Corinthians doesn't fit the description of it, so it must be 1.5 Corinthians. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Like, this is really, you know, come on, Paul. But the point is, the more we understand the genres in the Bible, or like the type of literature that we're working with, the more reasonable our expectations will be and the more fruitful our reading will be. So we won't be slogging through Judges, kind of waiting for the inspiring quote. And actually, the inspiring quotes are there in the book of Judges. You just have to keep reading. But you won't have a kind of artificial idea of how to get blessed while reading the book of Judges. And you won't have a kind of unfair expectation of some parts of the Bible that they'll give all the information that you might have hoped. So those are just a couple examples of how having good expectations can really help us as Bible readers. And then I wonder, do you all know the 3 big types of literature that there are in the Bible? Don't look at your sheet. Anyone want to take a guess? If I told you there are 3 major kinds of writing in the Bible, what would you say they are?
Poetry.
What's that?
Poetry.
Poetry, yeah.
Narrative.
And the third one's kind of a lame one, but yeah, Denny?
Literature,
yeah, I think that's a good term. Prose is the term I've used, basically because some things aren't narrative and they're not poetry, so they're prose. Okay, It's kind of the miscellaneous category. So let's talk about each of those in turn, okay? Now, narrative. Narrative can mean just a story. Like, that could be all it means, just that English word narrative. When we talk about the Bible's narrative, we're talking about historical narrative. And generally speaking, it's all historical in nature. There's no historical novels in the Bible. There's no, like, you know, what it would have been like to live under the days of, under the reign of King David. Nothing like that. It's just, here's a historical narrative about King David and Israel during that time. So by narrative, we mean historical narrative, pretty much 100%. Poetry. What parts of the Bible do you think of when we talk about poetry?
Psalms.
Psalms would be an especially good example, yes?
Prophets.
Prophets, yeah. Generally speaking, the prophets wrote in poetry. They didn't write prose, or they didn't write narrative. In the books called the Latter Prophets. So actually, if you turn over, you have one of my handy-dandy charts. And you'll notice the former prophets, they're all historical narrative, just like the books of Moses. But then starting with Isaiah, you get book after book after book after book of almost straight poetry, not completely. So for instance, the book of Jonah is narrative. It's tucked away in the prophets. And there are narrative sections of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. But the larger pattern is that it's mostly poetry. Stuart, you're looking at me with
it. Major prophets are the ones that are poetry? Is that what you're saying?
The latter prophets is the term I've been using. So as opposed to Joshua to Kings, so if you look at the chart, you'll see Isaiah all the way through the minor prophets, the 12. Those are the latter prophets. Former and latter is referring to the Hebrew order of the canon that we'd been talking about a few weeks ago. And the 12 is the minor prophets. That's what we would call them.
Okay.
Yeah. I just don't like using the word minor prophet, because I'm going to get to heaven and I'm going to meet Malachi and be like, hey, you're one of the minor prophets. And he'll be like, man, what was with you people? Okay. You know, he'll probably be some hulking, massive dude. And I'll be like, I really wish I had never said that. So that's one. What's that?
It's heaven.
Yeah, he'll be really nice, but still, there's lots of nice guys that I would never call minor. the prophets, and then the Psalms, the writings, most of them are narrative, or excuse me, most of them are poetry. Interestingly, the last books in the writings, so Daniel to Chronicles, it returns to narrative. So you get this sort of structure of a narrative foundation, and then a bunch of poetry reflecting on the whole narrative, and then a tailpiece of narrative again. And the narratives at the end of the Old Testament have this quality of just capping off the whole message. So they show us how the story concludes, and actually provide something of a review of the whole thing, because Chronicles has this quality of being a review of everything from the beginning. Narrative, poetry, narrative. That's the large structure.
Why do you have Michael? Esther as poetry?
Yeah, see, it's a handy-dandy chart, Michael. Another level of chart-making skill could have solved this problem. But yeah, if you look at the five scrolls, the middle part of the writings, two of those books are narrative.
Yeah, Ruth.
Ruth and Esther. And Ecclesiastes is not normal poetry either. I'd probably call that prose. A lot of it. It has some poems, but there's large sections that are not really poetry. So, so remember, it's a handy-dandy chart, not a chart to be, don't hang this up in a museum or anything, okay? Now, the interesting thing is that the New Testament has a very similar structure. So the opening of the New Testament is five books of narrative. This is more than half, like way more than half of the New Testament is Matthew to Acts, is the historical narrative of Christ's coming, his life, ministry, death, resurrection, ascension to heaven, and the aftermath of his ministry in the ministry of the apostles at the founding of the church, until we get to the point where Paul has brought the gospel to the whole world in principle, by bringing it to Rome. So that's the historical narrative. How do we get from a situation where only a few faithful Jews like Simeon and Anna knew God to a situation where the true knowledge of God was known in the capital of the world? That's Matthew to Acts. Amazing story. Wonderful narrative. And that narrative foundation then sets you up for not a large section of poetry, but a large section of what I'm calling prose. And I admit prose is kind of a general term. It's not specific enough, but it would be a way to describe the epistles. They're writing more like straightforward teaching. So it's not necessarily writing poetry, but it's like the prophets in the sense that it records their preaching. So the books of the prophets are records of their preaching, and the letters of the apostles are records of their preaching. And the way that they would explain the gospel, the way they apply the historical narrative that has come before. And then the book of Revelation. And here I admit this is a little bit forced, okay? Don't hang this part of the chart in a museum. But when you think about it, Revelation and Chronicles, we talked about this last week, but there's a lot of similarities between those two books when you think about their respective places in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I would say, if I had to pick between narrative, poetry, or prose, narrative would be the right thing to choose for Revelation. It does have some letters. It does have some songs. But by and large, it's actually a narrative of things from heaven's perspective, of things that are happening at present and things that have yet to happen. And it's quite a strange narrative in the sense that it's not based on the kind of evidence that we would have for, say, the Book of Kings, right, of historical documents and that sort of thing. It's narrative based on a visionary revelation to John, and it's narrative of things happening in heaven or things happening in the future or both. So it's different, but still I would suggest that it fits into that narrative category better than either of the other two. And that means you have a kind of basic structure to the both testaments, where you have foundational narrative giving a historically based revelation of the true God to his people. And then you have a long section of teaching about what that narrative means. And then you have a final section capping it all off and giving a prospect for the future. That's the sort of the basic structure of the Old Testament, and it's the basic structure of the New. Historical narrative, teaching about what it means, and then a cap. With a prospect for the future. And when you look at it that way, both the Old and the New Testament have this amazingly coherent quality, and they seem much less like a kind of random list of books organized who knows how. They're much more purposefully arranged than you might have thought. And in that way, I think seeing this order is helpful. A few weeks ago, we talked about how the English order is based on the Septuagint and everything, and it's not like it's heresy to put the books in a different order or anything like that, but it is nice to see the structure and how it fits together. Even if you can just know there is a structure and it feels good that God would be so purposeful, and then you can't quite remember the details all the time, and you have to go back to the chart that you did not hang in a museum. So my point is, you don't have to like remember all the details, but I think this basic structure of narrative as a foundation, poetry or prose as commentary on the narrative, and then a kind of narrative cap is a really helpful way of seeing how the whole Bible fits together. Does anyone have any questions about this? Okay. I want to talk a bit more about poetry then. What do you think is the main reason that God would give so much poetry in the Bible? It's about half of the Bible. It's at least half of the Old Testament. It's not half of the New, but half of the Old is poetry. Why is there so much poetry, Michael?
It helps in memorization.
Memorization, okay. Pat?
Well, this comes back to our theology reading a little bit, right? So, in some ways, God is very, very unlike us when he created that.
Yeah.
To kind of even start to approach understanding, you can't limit yourselves to what you would normally do when you're studying human events or human reasoning or so on, right?
Yep.
There are aspects of God that you can only kind of indirectly approach, and so metaphor, analogy, song.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I think that's actually, I think the, well, that's another good one. So poetry has a metaphorical sort of toolkit that's useful for theology. I think that's a good way to summarize it. Kevin?
I think it's because God cares about beauty.
Beauty?
And
uh-huh.
Poetry is song is a reflection of beauty that narrative and prose is less so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Jeannie?
I feel like it's, in the older days, there were less published books. So it kind of
has to be. Right. So like what Michael said about memorizing, it'd be helpful. Yeah, that would fit together quite well. Yep. Brad, were you going to say something?
I was going to say beauty.
Okay. Gene?
Worship, because we use it in singing.
Yeah, that's right. A corporate recitation or singing of a poem is fitting. Yep. Denise?
Sometimes you can sum things up that in prose would have taken more sentences to say.
Yeah. Yeah. A rose by any other name is just as sweet, is a lot shorter than some people call things, you know. Yeah. Good. Bob?
I think it also is that poetry is a way of communicating, I don't like the word necessarily, feelings, your heart, mm-hmm. how you are inside. It's much more expressive than writing. You know, it takes a lot more words to do that in prose.
Yeah.
You can do it in a much more simpler, powerful way.
Okay. Well, let's test some of these points. First of all, memorizing. I would say, actually, that all of the genres in the Bible are good for memorizing and good for this kind of publication situation. And as evidence, I submit the fact that little kids can tell the entire Joseph story very, very well. Maybe not in the exact words, but the whole structure of the narrative, it just, narratives stick in the mind amazingly. So I'd say poetry is like that, and narrative is also like that. And the Bible uses both very powerfully. Another thing I'd point out is that some of the most memorized parts of the Bible are from the epistles, which are not poetic in nature so much as prose, but they still have this amazing literary quality of being memorable. So I'd say that... that's a good quality of poetry, but I wouldn't say it's a distinguishing feature of poetry. It's not unique. Beauty. I think it would be interesting to have a sort of beauty contest. Which part of the Bible is the most beautiful? There's different kinds of beauty. Honestly, some of the narrative portions in the Bible are very lovely. Some of the letters are very beautiful in their writing. I do think, actually, if you come to appreciate Paul's letters, one of the reasons you come to appreciate them is for the beauty of their writing. So again, I agree that it is beautiful, and then I'm trying to think, is it truly distinguishing feature of poetry that it's beautiful? I have to think about it a little bit more. I don't deny that it could be. Feelings. Again, it just makes me think of places in Paul's letters where he expresses so much feeling, but he doesn't use poetry to do it. My heart, my heart is filled with sorrow for my people. For instance, in Romans 9, he's clearly moved to great emotion. So it's interesting trying to test these different things. And so at the risk of explaining them all away, I've just said no to almost all of your answers. I'm sorry, Pat, I feel like I gave you the inside track on this a couple weeks ago by giving away, because we talked about this at SAT. So sorry, everybody. Pat got it right. But I do think this is the central issue in poetry. And I actually changed this part about my lesson from the first time I taught this, because I used to use the explanation of feeling or beauty as the explanation, but then I thought about it more and realized, no, there's actually something even more fundamental going on. Think about the statement, God is a rock. Think about that statement. Is that a true statement? God is a rock. I'd say, how dare you say God is a rock? He's not a rock. He's the creator of the world. He's infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. And then the answer comes back, yeah, just like a rock, right? Yeah. You see the point? So that quality of language, and then here's the sort of answer to my own answer, is that if you were to get a book on poetry by a linguistic expert. There's a few I can think of who would say this is not a quality of only poetry, but actually of all language, that there's ways in which we use metaphor no matter how we're speaking. And we say things that the more you think about it, they're not quite literally true. But that's the only way we can get any message across, is by using a metaphor to compare one thing to another. So poetry is like a heightened version of that, where you have a lot of conscious attention paid to calibrating exactly in what sense is this metaphor true. So for instance, hide me under the shadow of your wings is a very typical biblical poetic statement. And the amazing thing about that genre in the Bible is it doesn't miscommunicate. Nobody comes away thinking, oh yeah, God has wings, and if I pay close attention, I'll see the shadow somewhere, and I'll try to hide in it. Like, you know, it just doesn't happen. And it's partly because, now in other religions actually, they do fail to make this distinction. So, for instance, people worship their false gods by putting food out for them and stuff. And, you know, do we feed God? Well, no, and we've never been under the impression that we feed God, partly because of how carefully the Bible communicates to us about God's relationship with us. So, for instance, Jesus says in John, and here I'm not going to use poetry, so this is a good example of my own critique coming home to roost. Jesus says, if anyone obeys my Father, my Father and I will come in and dine with him. That's in John 14. Now, does anyone think that God the Father needs to have a meal in order to spend time with us? Is he going to come in and dine? Well, no, because the Bible so carefully uses poetry to show us in what sense different things are true. And the way in which this is true is that God will really meet with us and commune with us and spend time with us. And even spending time with us is such a metaphorical way of speaking about God, right? And to get to the bottom of it, what I'm saying is there's no hard and fast distinctions between these three things, but I do think the deepest reason for poetry is this issue of what's the true way to speak about God. And actually, poetry is an especially good one because it highlights the limitations of our language. We can't use any poetry without being aware of the fact that we're not quite speaking literally or in the normal sense of the terms. God's not actually a rock, of course, but he actually is a rock, really, truly, even more truly than a rock is a rock, God is a rock. So there's lots to think about when we praise God using the poetic terms of the Bible. Have I confused everybody? I've sort of said yes and no to everything. So pardon me, I think all of the possible answers are good insights. And then I'm sort of suggesting that we can see under the surface a little bit more how all these insights can be partly true, and there may be a little bit more to the story. Yeah, Michael?
The problem is because the narrative often mixes in quite a bit of poetry,
yeah,
and the whole way this narrative is structured, you get things that are poetic images. I mean, I just happen to be thinking about Mount Sinai, which
yeah,
to me is one of the most powerful parts of the Bible.
Yeah.
There you have a depiction of God that's both literal and figurative.
Yep.
And it's a stunning revelation of God's power and people's reaction to it.
I mean, but
that's, you know, your classification, is something wrong with it. It's narrative, not poetry.
Yeah.
It's really, what a moving story.
Well, it gets very philosophical quick, because now we're not talking about the classification of literature. We're actually talking about just reality itself is so poetic.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing? And, you know, the Bible's word for God's works in the world is poem. Poema in Greek means work of art or something God has done or made in an artistic way. And that's how the Bible describes all of God's actions. They are poetic, right? So I totally agree that the historical, even the events themselves are poetic before they get into the Bible to be literature that's poetic. So that's a very good insight. I want to conclude with a few thoughts about how these genres work together. Because they do work together very wonderfully. And there's a couple examples that I have. Let me just... if you have a Bible, I'll point you to Psalm 78 as an example. And I'll give you a minute. If you look at Psalm 78, tell me what genre it is. I'll just let you look at it, and I'll awkwardly stand here watching you.
It's a narrative in poetry.
Yes, that's right. It's a poem giving a historical narrative. Where in the Bible do we find the same narrative that Psalm 78 gives us in poetry?
In Exodus.
Yeah, mostly in the book of Exodus, right.
Deuteronomy.
Now, there's a clear difference between the book of Exodus and Psalm 78, right? We can see the difference in the literature. So this distinction between poetry and narrative is really a real distinction. And yet, it's interesting that one of the main ways that God uses poetry is to retell narratives in poetic form. And I would say that one of the main benefits of something like Psalm 78 is it's a lot shorter than the book of Exodus, for one, so thus more memorable, as Michael was saying. It has much more vivid imagery. So, Kevin, what you were saying about how vivid and compelling, or Bob, what you were saying about how emotional poetry can be, just an example, verse 30 of Psalm 78 talks about while the food was still in their mouths, God's judgment fell. I mean, it doesn't say that in Exodus quite the same way, but like they got the quail meat right there in their teeth and they haven't yet flossed and God's judgment comes. It's very vivid, and I'm not sure it's beautiful, actually. It's more like ugly. It's like showing the opposite of beauty, but the point is, I think it's a very good one, that's very vivid. And then think about how easy it would be to teach Psalm 78 to your kids if you didn't have a family Bible at home. Like Jeannie was saying, you know, we can't afford a Bible, but I can teach you Psalm 78 for free, right? So you can see how all the different things that we've done are very good insights into the purpose of poetry. One other thing about how the genres work together is that there's some situations where they switch. So I'll give you a few examples of genre switches, and I hope you'll remember this when you're reading the Bible and you'll find your own genre switches, okay? If you look at Exodus 14 and 15, this is a good one. If someone could tell me, what's the genre of Exodus 14 and what's the genre of Exodus 15? And what's the actual topic of the two chapters? Matt, you're nodding in what looks like insight. Is that me doing mind reading?
No mind reading, but was pointing this out earlier. Like there are portions of scripture where we have narrative, and there's a poem. Actually, I'm struggling to think of a genre where, oh no, I guess the prophets, where it's largely poetry, and then suddenly you have a narrative explaining the background to the poem.
So yeah, I'll show you one in just a second, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, so Exodus 14 is narrative about...
Suddenly you have the poetic exposition of the narrative.
Yes, exactly. And it's the same events in both. So Pharaoh dies in both chapter 14 and chapter 15, and God wins, and Pharaoh dies, and Israel is happy. Yeah, that's right. He died twice. He died in narrative, and he died in poetry. And he's going to die in prose later on in the Bible. Yeah, good point. Yeah. But yeah, same topic. And all of a sudden, there's a poem stuck in here. And amazing, isn't it? And then if you look at Exodus 32, since we're in Exodus, for chapters it's been prose. It's been laws about the Sabbath and the tabernacle and all this stuff. What genre starts in chapter 32? Yeah, you get three chapters of narrative about the golden calf and the sin of Israel at Mount Sinai. And then in chapter 35, you're back to laws. So there's this little chunk of narrative dropped in the context of a whole bunch of laws. Matt, you were looking for a reverse genre switch from poetry to narrative. If you look at Isaiah 36, we've just had 35 chapters of poetry, almost. Not quite, because chapter 7 is narrative. But you had a lot of chapters of poetry. And then, all of a sudden, you get chapters 36 to 39 telling the story of the invasion of the Assyrians. Why is it right there? We'll come back to that someday when we study Isaiah. But
it's almost an exact copy from Kings.
Yeah, in fact, that's correct. Yeah, so it's likely the source material for what ends up in Kings. Yes, that's right. I'm not sure if we know for sure which way it is. Yeah, yep. So that narrative clearly has something to do with the message that Isaiah's been preaching. And he says, now look, there's this historical narrative that shows you what I mean. It's not just sermons, it's real.